NATO members must finally contribute their fair share and meet their financial obligations. But 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they are supposed to be paying for their defense. This is not fair to the people and taxpayers of the United States. And many of these nations owe massive amounts of money from past years.
President Trump at NATO headquarters in Brussels yesterday, using the opening of NATO's new headquarters to rhetorically wag his finger at his fellow heads of state. A long overdue increase in pressure or diplomatic malpractice depends on your perspective. The NATO meeting visits in Rome and Israel and Saudi Arabia. It has been a week on the world stage for Trump, what he called on Twitter, my big foreign trip. We'll take stock of where he stands as he heads home this weekend. We'll also look ahead at the battles waiting for him as he returns to Washington and the White House efforts to beef up their defenses. We'll start with the overseas trip with Susan Glasser, who is Politico's chief international affairs columnist. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. Well, foreign policy types are still trying to get their heads around the Trump's debut on the world stage. What is the reaction there in Europe?
Well, you know, they were worried about Donald Trump, and you could argue that he gave them reason yesterday to show why they were worried about the reception. Of course, this is a guy who campaigned on NATO being obsolete, who questioned the value of the European Union, who supported right-wing populists. He came to town not to charm when it came to Brussels yesterday, but to make a point, and a point he did make. He literally physically showed America first by shoving aside the Montenegrin leader at the NATO summit, giving rise to 1,000 waggish tweets. Mm-hmm. But more substantively, he refused to specifically endorse NATO's Article 5, which is the self-defense, the mutual defense provision that's the key part of the NATO alliance. He disagreed with the European Union leaders about policy toward Russia. And just generally, anyone looked for just a second at those pictures had a pretty clear sense, I'm sure, that this was not the warm, fuzzy meeting of anyone's dreams.
Yeah, you saw a lot of reaction and not good reaction on the faces of the European leaders as he was making that speech. And even Emmanuel Macron of France sidestepping him to greet the other leaders before greeting Donald Trump. What do you think, if there is going to be any longstanding damage from this speech to the relationship between the United States and Europe?
Well, look, first of all, it bears repeating. This is not the first time that Europe and the United States have had disagreements over policy. In the Reagan era, in the George W. Bush era, Europe and the United States were not at all on the same page on crucial issues, many involving Russia when it came to Reagan and how to deal with the Soviet Union. In the case of Bush, of course, the Iraq War opened up a major rift with European allies, and there were huge protests across the continent. So again, it's not unprecedented to have hostilities. However, Trump's personal disdain for these partners and the feeling seems to be very mutual. I can't remember anything like that. So number one, they're not going to be on close personal terms. Number two, I do think that it is confirmed for us that despite the best efforts, even of his own staff, remember, we've had them reassuring European allies, don't worry, it's okay. He is, in fact, on the same page with you on Russia. That's actually not the case. And we see that Donald Trump meant it that he still is interested in having some kind of a different and closer relationship with Vladimir Putin, despite the misgivings of his own advisors and of his European allies.
And a closer relationship with Sunni Arabs. During that speech yesterday, he spoke kindly about his visit to Saudi Arabia.
There I spent much time with King Salman, a wise man who wants to see things get much better rapidly.
So he seemed to have a much cozier relationship at the beginning of this trip in the Middle East with the Sunni Arabs than he did at the end with the European leaders.
Well, that's right. Many people have noted that President Trump specifically said in his speech in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia, I won't lecture you anymore, dot, dot, dot. Point being, we won't nag you about human rights and other pesky issues as Barack Obama and all previous American presidents have done. So the juxtaposition between not lecturing the Sunni Arabs in one of the world's most repressive societies, the optics of that all-male dance party, and then going to Europe the leaders along with the United States of the West, the free world, and lecturing them, I think, is going to be one of the indelible impressions here. The Middle East and our partners, our allies in the Middle East, were really disillusioned during the Obama years. They really felt that America had walked away from its leadership position, and they've been probably the most pro-Trump leaders anywhere in the world and most eager to start working with him. I'm not sure they came away from the trip with a clear sense of what exactly that means, but a very positive reception, literally rolling out the red carpet for him.
Susan Glasser, Politico's chief international affairs columnist. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the president returns home this weekend, and to help us figure out what he faces upon his return, we're joined now by Josh Barrow. He is host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center and senior editor at Business Insider. Hello.
Hey, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Well, I wonder if he's a little reluctant to come home. He is a famous homebody, but there's not a lot of good news waiting for him when it comes to Russia, the investigation, Comey, healthcare. Anything
yeah,
good?
I think he might have been, if you'd asked him in the Mideast portion of the trip, I think he might have been reluctant to come home. But I don't think he's had such a warm reception in Europe. So I think that he might be pleased to get out of there. But yeah, I think that what awaits him at home is not pretty. I actually think the special prosecutor gives him a little bit of a reprieve in a funny way. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, these the Comey memos that have been subpoenaed by various congressional committees, the FBI is delaying turning them over because they want to wait and see what the special counsel wants disclosed and when. So as Robert Mueller gets up to speed, that will for a time actually slow the process of the investigation, or at least the public results of the investigation. But certainly that's looming over their head. We have this news report that Jared Kushner is of some sort of interest in the investigation, not necessarily a person of interest in the sense of somebody that they might be looking to indict, but it's certainly that they are looking at him about something. And then substantively policy-wise, he still has to deal with this very unpopular health care bill, a budget that Republican members of Congress are calling dead on arrival in Congress. And then they have to raise the debt ceiling by the August recess, which is still a few months away, but there are going to be some legislative crises that get forced on the president, in addition to the ones that he has sort of created himself on health care and taxes.
Yeah. And so was it notable that he released his budget while he was out of the country?
Yeah. Well, I mean, budgets are sort of a funny thing. The law requires the president to release a budget every year. And Congress, even when Congress gets along better with the president, they often sort of look at the budget and laugh and then write their own appropriations bills or spending bills. And so a lot of the stuff that's in this budget that people are freaking out about, enormous cuts to the National Institute of Health, it's clear that Congress is not actually going to do those things. And part of why this budget is so draconian is that Donald Trump wants to be able to claim to balance the budget within 10 years, which we're not even close to being able to do, especially with promises that he's made, like having a huge tax cut. So the budget he's proposed doesn't even contain his own tax cut plan. In fact, it says that we'll get an increase in tax revenue over and above what's expected under current law, because he'll grow the economy so fast, we'll get that extra revenue, and then we won't lose any revenue due to a tax cut. So obviously that's not going to happen. And then, you know, Congress is already fighting over whether the Affordable Health Care Act would cut Medicaid too much. He's proposing enormous Medicaid cuts on top of that that could cut the program by as much as half by 2026. And so Congress is not going to go for things like that. But if you admit that you're not going to cut programs like Medicaid that deeply, if you admit that you're trying to do an enormous tax cut, then you have to admit that you're going to run enormous budget deficits for the foreseeable future, which he doesn't want to. So they produce this budget that just bears no relationship to reality.
Okay, so finally, I want to ask you about this week's special election in Montana. Republican Greg Gianforte, he won yesterday despite his body slamming of a reporter. And what do you see in terms of what this augurs for the Democrats going forward?
Well, I mean, if you look at this special election and the ones that we've had in Kansas in the first round of the election in Georgia, you're seeing Democrats doing about 9 points better than you might expect them to in an election where the vote was perfectly tied nationally. And if that that overperformance was replicated in 2018, Democrats wouldn't just take back the House. They'd take it back by a wide margin. So no, Rob Quist didn't do well enough to win Montana, but Montana is very heavily Republican. Of all of the congressional districts that Trump won the presidential election in, he won by a smaller margin than he won in Montana in something like 112 of them, which is to say Democrats don't need to take back Montana to take back the House. They don't need to take back places that look anything like Montana. So if they're able to come within six there, they ought to be able to get over the top in enough districts to win the election next year. Now, that said, general elections are different from special elections. Incumbents have advantages in getting reelected. Democrats have been able to throw a lot of money and energy at these specials because they happen one at a time. That'll be more distributed in the general election. But if I were the Republicans, I would not be taking comfort in this result. This is not a strong enough performance in Montana to indicate that they are on track to retain the House of Representatives when all of the seats come up next year.
All right. Thanks, Josh.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Josh Barrow. He is senior editor at Business Insider and host of KCRW's political show and podcast Left, Right, and Center. You can listen to that at 7 o'clock tonight. Well, we're getting a clearer picture now of how President Trump's hardline policies on immigration are playing out. Immigrant arrests shot up nearly 40% in the first 3 months of President Trump's term, according to recent Immigration and Customs Enforcement data. But during that time period, a U.S. citizen from San Bernardino also found herself detained by ICE. In March, Guadalupe Plasencia was picked up by police on an outstanding warrant. She was then transferred to the custody of the San Bernardino County Sheriff. And as she was leaving jail the next day, ICE arrested her despite her insistence that she is an American citizen. The American Civil Liberties Union has a pending lawsuit against ICE and the Sheriff's Department over this case. And ACLU attorney Adriana Wong, who represents Plasencia, is here on the line. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so tell us more about this case. Why was she picked up in the first place and arrested by the sheriff?
This is a case of a clerical error, possibly mistaken identity. Since then, the supposed warrant that was issued against Ms. Plasencia has been cleared up. But that's exactly what this case demonstrates. A lot of times you'll hear local law enforcement agencies saying that their collaboration with immigration enforcement is intended to prevent the release of dangerous criminals, but actually their policies catch all sorts of people who are arrested by mistake, or as the result of a wrongful arrest. And that's what happened in this case.
Okay, so she was arrested, and then as she's leaving, ICE picks her up and holds her for how long?
We're not quite sure because Ms. Plasencia was understandably quite distraught during the whole ordeal, but we're talking about a matter of hours.
Okay. And the Sheriff's Department has a policy, apparently, that they're not honoring detainer requests, right? That they don't hold suspects or hold released prisoners for ICE.
Yes and no. So the Sheriff's Department no longer will hold people in their jail cells in response to an ICE detainer. But what the Sheriff's Department will do, and they're quite public about this, is notify ICE about a detainee's release time, and they will make the building, the parking lot, their lobby available to ICE officers to make the arrests on their premises.
But here she is, an American citizen. She's been fingerprinted. And where is the mix-up? Why doesn't ICE believe her?
That's really what's quite shocking about this case. The Sheriff's Department knew that she was an American citizen. She made that clear to them from the very beginning. That's how she's recorded in their booking documents. She presented her driver's license to ICE and told them she was a citizen, but nevertheless, she was arrested. Unfortunately, this isn't the first time that ICE has arrested an American citizen, and our client was very afraid that they would deport her, and it wouldn't have been the first time ICE has deported an American citizen. ICE simply just isn't reliable when it comes to identifying citizens.
So how did she get out? How was she released?
Eventually, her daughter brought her passport to the ICE processing center, and once they were able to review that passport there and compare it to her driver's license and whatever information they may have in their database, they decided that was satisfactory.
And how was she treated while she was in ICE custody?
With suspicion. You know, they never issued an apology to her when they released her. At one point, and Ms. Plasencia can perhaps speak to this better than I can, she was told that she didn't have an identity, that she wasn't a person until ICE had determined what that was.
Oh, wow. Well, so what is your suspicion in terms of whether or not this was just a clerical error, a mistake, or if there was something more sinister happening?
I think that there is a systemic problem with ICE not having sufficient records or caring to keep sufficient records about who a citizen is. And I also think it shows the major flaws in having a sheriff's department or local law enforcement policy that relies so completely on the information that they receive from the federal government, knowing that there are often flaws in that and knowing that they have their own records that may completely contradict what ICE is saying.
And you say this is not the first time an American citizen has either been arrested or even deported. How many have been arrested and deported? Do you know?
According to studies, we're talking about hundreds, maybe thousands of American citizens that have been arrested or deported by ICE. I'm aware of one such case in L.A. fairly recently. There are cases recently that have happened in Texas and other states. So it's really a more widespread problem than I think most of us understand.
And this is not just in the last 3 months. This has been happening for years, right?
This has been happening for years, but I think with ramped up immigration enforcement, and especially if we continue to have such tight collaboration between local law enforcement and ICE, we can expect to see more of this.
And what does your lawsuit want? What are you seeking?
Well, at the end of the day, I think Ms. Lucentia is mostly interested in the vindication of her rights and a recognition that she was unlawfully imprisoned. The mechanism that we're using to seek that asks for compensation for her harms in the form of money damages. But I think the recognition that her rights have been violated is really what's at the heart of this case.
And so far as you know, ICE has not said anything to that, to you or to your client.
No, we have not heard anything from ICE in response to our claims yet, and certainly the ICE agents that detained and interrogated Ms. Lucentia never made any sort of indication that they were apologetic for any violation of her rights.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's ACLU attorney Adriana Wong. We also reached out to ICE and the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department. In a statement, ICE said it is barred from releasing information related to people who are U.S. citizens, but that it would never knowingly detain someone if there was evidence that person was a citizen. And a spokeswoman for the Sheriff's Department says that every prisoner goes through the same booking process and that they do not inform ICE about any person's immigration status. Coming up, billionaire Jerry Parencio's rules included this one: stay out of the spotlight, it fades your suit. We'll put the spotlight on him next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. LA billionaire Jerry Parencio had a long and varied career. Here are some highlights. He built a talent agency. He produced hit movies and TV shows. He promoted the fight of the century between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier and the battle of the sexes tennis match between Bobby Riggs and Billie Jean King. And he transformed the Spanish language network Univision into a media empire and a Fortune 500 company. Well, Jerry Parencio died this week. And for more on the billionaire's life and his accomplishments, we're joined now by Meg James, corporate media reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Meg.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, he certainly had a career, as I mentioned, full of highlights. Tell us more about how he came to be a billionaire. How did he start out?
Well, I mean, his track record in Hollywood was really quite enviable because he seemed to have this exquisite sense of timing where he'd get into deals just before, you know, such an industry would take off. I think that he really became a billionaire, I guess that would be probably in the 90s. Certainly, he was a billionaire before his Univision investment, although that, when Univision went public, that probably helped certify his billionaire status.
And he worked with Norman Lear, right, on some of those quintessential 70s sitcoms?
Yes. Actually, Norman Lear needed a business partner, someone who really knew business, because he was such a creative type. So he once told me that when they brought Jerry into their production firm, it really became a business, not two creative guys sort of, you know, fooling around and making these really quintessential 1970s shows like All in the Family. Jerry came a little bit later than that, although he was involved in The Jeffersons and One Day at a Time.
Those are pretty quintessential, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So he was also a big political donor. What were his political leanings?
Oh, my goodness. He was very much a Republican, one of the probably the biggest Republican donors in Los Angeles. Over the years, he gave to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He helped build the, at least finance, not build it per se, but helped finance the Reagan Library in Simi Valley. He gave, I was struck this week that he gave more than $3 million to Carly Fiorina in her bid last year for the presidency. So he also was very generous on the local level, Richard Reardon, Antonio Villaraigosa, and others.
And yet, he's not a household name, even though I think Fortune or someone rated him as worth $2.5 billion. Not a lot of people knew his name. Why?
Well, that was Jerry's making. He really did not want to be in the spotlight. And it's interesting because only in the last few years were we able to interview him for the first time in more than a quarter century. 3 years, I guess it was 2.5 years ago, my colleague David Ng did a very strong story when Jerry decided to leave the majority of his very extensive art collection to LACMA. And so we interviewed him in 2014. But before that, it was quite, I remember many, many years ago when I was first starting out on the beat, I sent a letter to ask to interview Mr. Parencio, and I got a very nice typewritten letter back from his assistant, Jan, saying, you know, Mr. Parencio does not give interviews. So he really, it was partly, and what I've been told by Andy Williams, believe it or not, and others, is that he was a talent agent to begin with, and he did not want to take away or steal the spotlight from his clients. And so therefore, he learned and thrived in sort of, behind the scenes.
Yeah, so he has these rules of the road, he calls them, and one of them was stay out of the spotlight, it fades your suit. So was it also that he realized that no good could come of being in the media?
I think so, because when I was researching the profiles, actually a profile I did more than a decade ago, he was quoted a lot in the LA Times back in the 70s and early 80s. I think as he became, more prominent, he was called to testify in Congress with some of his dealings in Vegas. There were never any allegations of anything shady on his part, I might add, but I think that he just found that if he promoted the talent or his businesses, that would promote teamwork within his companies and there would be less rivalries and things would run smoother. But he was very much, I think I would call him an authoritarian in his business. I mean, people very much respected him. People loved working for him. They found him to be a gentleman and hugely, hugely just brilliant at business.
Meg James, corporate media reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And Jerry Parencio was an art lover. His personal collection, filled with works by Monet, Manet, Picasso, Magritte, and others, valued at more than $500 million. That collection is going to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. The announcement was made back in 2014, and here's what Parencio had to say about it then.
I hope the gift of my art collection to LACMA will inspire other collectors to do the same and encourage all types of donations, large and small. Hopefully more large than small.
Okay, Michael Govan, CEO and director of LACMA, is here now. Welcome back.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Well, we talked to you back then in 2014 when that announcement was made. When are we now going to see these paintings?
Well, there's no answer to that specifically. You know, during our 50th anniversary recently, he only allowed out just a handful so that people could get a taste of it. He was living with them, and he really loved them. So there's no specific timeline. The paintings were a bequest, and they were intended for the new building. He felt as strongly as anyone, if not more, that Los Angeles deserved a proper museum. That the museum buildings weren't that, and that if we were really serious about this project, that he would leave this bequest of masterpieces to help encourage us. And even then, I think we announced the county gift and his gift, the building project and the art, just to make it clear to the public that the value of the art's way higher than the value of the building.
Right. So the supervisors have given $125 million, right? Meaning you had to raise $475 million.
Right, and we're on our way. We're in the middle of that process, and just to say, Jerry Parencio not only pledged $25 million in 2016, just cash in addition to the art to get that going. But he was very involved behind the scenes, and he was extremely helpful to me and encouraging. That brilliant business advice you were just talking about, you know, he was giving that to me a little bit in how to proceed and pull all this together. He was an incredibly generous man, not only with his art and his funds, but also with his time and his thoughts with me.
Okay, but we can't see the works until the new building is built, right? That's the string
attached to
the request.
None of that is clear. He wasn't. We were hoping and anticipating that he would be there to cut the ribbon. So nothing's been discussed since then, and there just isn't information about that. But that was the intention, and we'll see what happens now. But the book actually was published. I don't know if you saw it a year and a half after the announcement. We published a beautiful book that outlines the whole collection with essays and has information about his life. So that's also accessible to the public right now.
Well, since this gift was announced, two major private collections have opened in L.A. There's the Broad Museum downtown, and just yesterday, the Marciano Art Foundation in Hollywood. So were you worried at all that Parencia would go that route, just have a private museum?
It's funny. He actually, he was very much from the beginning hoping that LACMA would feel strong enough to be a place he could leave his collection, because he really wanted to leave it to that big public, to the, you know, we have over a million and a half visitors, and he really wanted it to leave it to this civic place that is representative of the whole community, the many cultures, and he really loved L.A. I mean, that was so clear in every time I spent with him, even when he would have doubts about whether L.A. could achieve what it needed to civically and philanthropically, he was encouraging every step of the way. So I think what he really wanted was a situation here where it was beautiful enough, strong enough that it could receive his collection.
And has that announcement spurred other donations since he made it in 2014?
His announcement really was the cornerstone upon which we've built all the momentum. I mean, we're at about $300 million towards $650 million, and we continue to raise money. And I think that it was launched by, as it should be, by art, by, you know, the Monets, the Manets, the Picassos. I think everybody has an incentive to see this project happen, because they will have access to works of art like that. And yes, the level of art donations has risen extraordinarily since then. There was probably, and we don't use numbers but there was probably half that much given in promised gifts for our 50th anniversary just after the Parencia announcement. And I know everyone was encouraged to do it because of Jerry's largesse.
Michael Govan, CEO and Director of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up on the program, movie reviews and why Cannes should keep doing Cannes.
It's a film festival that has a standard, and it might be an arcane, idiosyncratic standard, but it's their standard.
Why the French booed Netflix movies, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, which means one thing and one thing only, time for film reviews. Also this week, we're going to talk about what's been going on at the Cannes Film Festival. This year, it lived up to its reputation as a festival unafraid of a little controversy. Fandango's Alicia Malone just got back from Cannes, and she'll be here to explain. Hi, Alicia.
Hello.
Okay, so hang tight while we talk about this week's movies with Dave White and Alonzo Giraldi, both reviewing for The Wrap, and they both host the Linoleum Knife podcast. Hi, you guys.
Hey, howdy.
Okay, first up, Captain Jack Sparrow is back. Where has he been?
Well, he went to Australia with some dogs that he wasn't supposed to bring, and then he got divorced, I think.
Okay.
Who are we talking about? Captain Jack. Oh,
Keith
Captain Jack
Richards,
Sparrow.
That guy. Here, let's hear a clip from Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales.
Well, today is your lucky day, because I just happen to be Captain Jack Sparrow.
No, it can't be. I've spent years searching for
This, the great Jack Sparrow, is not some drunk in a cell. Do we even have a ship? A crew? Pants?
Well, do we want to see him put on his pants? Do we want him...
We always want the pants on.
Do we want to see any more of him, is I guess what I'm asking.
That's a tough question to answer. I don't. But that's not... I'm an effete film critic, and and I am not, I'm going to say this thing that I usually never say. I'm not the audience for this movie.
Who is?
Children. This is the fifth Pirates movie, Dead Men Tell No Tales, which is not true because most of the characters in this movie are dead, and
they won't shut up.
They won't stop talking. This stars Johnny Depp. It stars Javier Bardem, and Orlando Bloom is back. And so the story goes, Bloom's son has found what he thinks is a way to break the curse that has kept Bloom in the undead and underwater. And the young man is working on a Navy ship. They come across a ghost ship that is helmed by Captain Salazar. This is Javier Bardem.
Who's a ghost.
With very cool... wiggly, floaty hair that was always flying around. Then they meet a young woman named Karina. She is an astronomer, and she knows that they have to all go find the Trident of Poseidon, and that will break all the ghost curses. Now, in
okay,
the meantime,
it's basically go to the place and get the thing.
Okay.
Yes.
Got
and
it.
And so... And that is what all of these
And the
films
only person
are.
Who can help them is...
Captain Jack Sparrow.
Okay. Yeah. But he's drunk and he's not wearing pants.
And,
you know, look, we saw this movie with a paying audience. We missed the press screenings. And there were people in the paying audience who still find Johnny Depp as Captain Jack Sparrow charming and funny, and they enjoyed his every utterance on screen. Like Dave, I am not the demographic of this movie. I am kind of over this whole
series.
It seems
like no film critic is, from what I have seen.
Robert Abley at The Wrap actually found himself shocked to really have a good time. They brought in, the directors were the guys that did this movie, Contiki, that was up for the Best Foreign Film Oscar a couple years ago. So there's an attempt to sort of inject a little life into this thing.
Okay, let's move on to War Machine, starring Brad Pitt.
I'm just... trying to work this thing out. President gave me a job to do.
Damn it, Glenn. What did we tell you? No more troops. Don't ask for more troops. What do you do?
You ask for 40,000.
Hey, hang on, Dick. You're cutting out. I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Something's wrong here.
Andy!
All right. Can you hear us now?
I can hear you!
Can't hear what you're saying.
No, totally no.
I'll talk to you later, Dick.
We need to finish.
I'm sorry,
we need to...
Okay, Alonzo, you saw this one, Brad Pitt playing General McMahon based on Stanley McChrystal
yeah.
in Afghanistan.
This is a movie that is really trying hard to be a satire about the war on terror and specifically the war in Afghanistan and its kind of waning days. And it's 2009. Obama has just come into office. He's trying to sort of, get us out of all of this. And this general is not having it. And he wants to double down and go into these areas that everybody's completely given up on. And it's a losing game and it's doomed to failure. And this movie never quite finds the tone to make that thing work. And there's a lot not working here, starting, unfortunately, with Brad Pitt, who I think is a terrific actor. But you see him acting so hard in this movie. He's doing a voice. He's doing a walk. He is wearing a nose. Like, there's just all this. There's so many external trappings of this performance that you can never sort of sink back and stop watching Brad Pitt acting his heart out, you know. And then it's also narrated densely from start to finish by Scoot McNairy, who we find out later is the Rolling Stone reporter.
Michael Hastings,
right.
Who died.
Yes, who writes the article that you know, brought down this general. But the idea of this article and what it represented and why it took down this general and then what the general wants to do in Afghanistan and why it's a bad idea are these two ideas that never quite connect or coexist in the movie. It's sort of like this happens, and then the article comes out and his career's over, bam, the end.
So it seems like it's trying a little bit to be Strange Lovian in depicting the absurdity
yeah.
of generals and war.
Catch-22-esque, you know. But yeah, it never nails that stuff, and when it does, it does it in a very familiar way. There are little moments in this movie that stand out. You know, Ben Kingsley plays Hamid Karzai as a guy who's way more interested in watching Blu-rays than leaving the palace and helping his country. Tilda Swinton has kind kind of a monologue as a German a politician who's asking hard questions of the general. There's little bits where this thing lands, but for the most part, it just kind of slogs through, and the narration is constantly telling you what you should know and how you should feel about it, and ultimately, this just doesn't work.
Okay, let's move on to something that looks as ridiculous as they come. Baywatch. It's a film adaptation of the old David Hasselhoff series, and here's a clip.
We're staring into the abyss here. It's up to us to restore the Baywatch brand.
Hey, One Direction, you here for the qualifiers?
I'm Matt Brody. I don't have to try out. I've got 2 gold medals.
Hey!
Matt Brody,
yes! We still don't give up.
Training begins. Okay. Dwayne Johnson, Zac Efron.
Restoring the Baywatch brand. You heard that line of dialogue. And that is the reason this film exists. This is a product that Paramount owned, I guess, that has been funded by 2 giant Chinese investment firms. This is about making a global entertainment product starring The Rock. It is a film that does not know what it is.
It's a weird hybrid between like hard R body comedy, D-bag comes of age story, because Zac Efron is basically playing like a Ryan Lochte disgraced Olympian who, you know, is seeking redemption. Or at times it's a seemingly unironic reboot of Baywatch. And these 3 things butt up against each other, and it's not successful at any of them.
Is it
not
funny at all?
It's not funny.
No.
It's so strained and so labored. And we have 21 Jump Street to blame for this. That movie landed, and it worked, and it was funny. And then everybody who owned an unloved, you know, pop culture punchline TV show thought, oh, I can make one of these. Yeah. And now we get Chips and then Baywatch.
Alonzo saw it at a press screening, and I saw it with a paying audience. And there were walkouts.
Wow. Oh. That is bad.
Yeah.
I really want to see the Golden Girls on the golden screen. How about that?
You know,
I'm open to anything.
Be careful what you wish for.
Because everything is going to happen.
Yeah.
Because nothing matters.
As Whitney Seibold says, there are no jokes anymore. If you the second that came out of your mouth, like it's now in development.
Okay, let's move on to Cannes. Hi, Alicia. You've been waiting patiently.
All of those films sound terrible.
Yeah, aren't you glad you're not reviewing movies this week? Yeah. So tell us about what happened at Cannes with Netflix. 2 movies there, and apparently they were booed by the fancy film goers.
Yeah, it's always so interesting to me how the Cannes film audience loves to boo, because they take things very seriously. They don't talk during the film. They don't text. Barely any walkouts. But you usually hear a boo right at the end if they're not happy with the film. This time with the 2 Netflix movies, Okja and The Meyerowitz Stories, there were boos at the Netflix logo, because this is the first time that they've had 2 Netflix movies in the competition vying for the Palme d'Or. The issue was not so much about streaming services, although I think that some people are still a bit snobby about streaming versus screening, and they want everything to be played on a big screen. The reason why the French press were upset was when these 2 films were included in the competition, they didn't have any theatrical release happening in France. So they felt like Cannes is supposed to be a film festival that's showcasing movies that you'll get to see in French cinemas. There's also that debate over whether you should see a film that's made for Netflix on the big screen. Okja is a film that has a lot of special effects. So I thought that one was great to see on the big screen. The Meyerowitz Stories is a very talky Noah Baumbach film that you can definitely watch at home. But the Okja screening, there was the boo at the Netflix logo, and then a continued sustained boo and clapping and cheering and whistling until the movie stopped, because there was a projection issue and the top sort of 1/8 of the screen was getting cut off. So the audience refused to watch the movie until they had stopped the movie and then screened it again from the start. And then, of course, when it screened for the second time, there was boos again at the Netflix logo. It's all a bit ridiculous, but it does bring up that interesting debate over streaming services and whether Cannes needs to move with the time.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of Okja?
I liked it. I felt like it was a very nice film. It's all about anti-consumerism, anti-capitalism. It's about these giant big pigs that get sent off to farmers. One of them, Okja, forms this bond with the young girl who's grown up with the pig. So when the pig has to go into America to get slaughtered and eaten, she doesn't want to let that happen. Great story, brilliant cast, but for me, and this is probably me being snobby, but I just didn't feel like that level of of the Cannes competition film. But it's a good film. It's one to watch at home. It's got my future husband, Jake Gyllenhaal, in it. He's great.
Now, this is by the guy who did Snowpiercer, right?
Yes, by Bong Joon-ho, mm-hmm. who did Snowpiercer.
Does the pig have a spider in the barn that weaves?
It's very Charlotte's Web. It is. It's that kind of dark children's film.
And is Tilda Swinton in this? With
Tilda Swinton's in it as well. A great cast. And I do like the fact that Netflix gave Bong Joon-ho $50 or $60 million to make whatever he wanted. So that's the advantage of having these streaming services making original films.
Hmm. And what about the Noah Baumbach movie? Good?
Noah Baumbach. If you don't like Noah Baumbach, then you definitely won't like this one. It's a very talky New York film about a dysfunctional family. I enjoyed it for what it was, but again, it's not one you need to see on the big screen. You can equally watch it, enjoy it at home. Adam Sandler is great. I was saying before that I much prefer him in dramas than comedies. Same with Ben Stiller, who plays his brother. They're both really good, in my opinion, in dramas, and I'm just kind of tired of them in comedies, so I enjoyed the cast. Dustin Hoffman in there, too.
Hmm. So, guys, what do you think of this Netflix controversy? Do you think that maybe there should be some old-fashioned film festivals and we'll leave Netflix?
This has been an ongoing thing. We see it with the cable channels. You know, HBO will run their documentaries theatrically in L.A. to qualify for Oscars. And, you know, the Oscars changed their rules this year, so a miniseries like O.J. Made in America would no longer qualify. I think what we'll probably see is the end result here is in the same way that Netflix is opening War Machine in L.A. theaters for a week, they will also set up a French release in, you know, a couple theaters in Paris to qualify for the Cannes Film Festival. But yeah, I mean, Netflix is, and Amazon, they're not even the future. They're the present. Yeah. They're happening. You know?
I'm glad they got booed.
Why?
Here's why. This is the Cannes Film Festival. Serious films, serious film goers, and those kinds of films that usually play at Cannes, you need them on a big screen. It's a film festival that has a standard, and it might be an arcane, idiosyncratic standard, but it's their standard. And they are keeping the flag of see a movie in a theater flying high. Keep booing that.
Well, they're still going to show them, though.
Yes.
And look, if boos this year mean that there's a requirement to play theatrically in France next year, then great. I think then everybody wins, because if you want to see it projected, you can. And also, it doesn't discriminate against Netflix for being a streaming service, but who is, like mm-hmm. Alicia said, giving Bong Joon-ho a fat check to make a movie, which a lot of studios wouldn't be
doing. I'm not anti-Netflix at all. I'm anti not giving a Cannes Film Festival film a run in a theater in the country that hosts the Cannes Film Festival.
Absolutely. And this was sort of the argument that Pedro Almodovar and Will Smith on The Jury had this year, where Almodovar is like, look, I will always love the sort of hypnotic cathedral experience of seeing a film on the big screen. And Will Smith said, I have three kids at home who watch stuff on Netflix all the time, and they still go to the movies in theaters. So mm-hmm. it's not like Netflix is stopping them from doing that.
And then when you have pirates playing in a theater in the big screen, you kind of like, well, so and?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not quality, it's not quality no matter what screen it's on.
Right.
Deep thoughts from me right there. Alonzo Duralde.
The deepest.
The deepest of deep. Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap, co-host of the movie podcast Linoleum Knife. Dave White, also film critic for The Wrap and also film critic for LinoleumKnife.com. Alicia Malone, correspondent for Fandango. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You might want to bring a map with you before heading up the coast for the three-day weekend. A bridge collapse in Big Sur has cut off residents since February, and it could take more than a year to fix. On top of that, a massive landslide at Mud Creek this past weekend meant closing down Highway 1 for a 12-mile stretch, and that could further complicate repairs of the bridge. California's rainy winter was to blame. Joining us to talk about this is Magnus Torin. He is the executive director of the Henry Miller Memorial Library in Big Sur. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you? The last time we spoke was earlier before this big landslide. So how does that complicate your life?
The recent one, you know, the main landslide, the one we're talking of now, is named Mud Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And that slid sometime in early this year and cut us off to the south. So we, in fact, have been cut off from the south for a long time. And we do have one other access road north of the southern cutoff that we can sometimes use for supplies and propane and a few things for the people that live south of the bridge. Now, in your lead in there, you said that the bridge would take up to a year to replace. The fact is that most likely the bridge will be done by mid September. So. Not that far in the future, and the impact of the unbelievable mud flow that just happened last Saturday, I believe it was, is that the fixing of the road there at that location may be more difficult, but also interestingly perhaps less difficult because the amount of dirt that came down and created this. Several acres of new, you know, oceanfront property down below the slide. It just filled in and it created a whole peninsula down there. That is so heavy and it has packed so much that theoretically it could create the new roadbed. So it's pending the engineers' results, but it's not out of the question that they will be able to sort of use the area that fell down as the roadbed for the future and making it perhaps not as extraordinarily difficult as it looks.
It certainly looks difficult just looking at the pictures from the sky. I mean, it looks like a massive mountain on top of Highway 1.
Yeah.
So would they just spread out that dirt along the highway? Is that what they're talking about?
I think in the marine sanctuary tells you that you can't you know, cast the dirt off the side. But I think at this time there'll be an exception made. So yeah, so there'll be you know hundreds of or I don't know how many thousands of truckloads or bulldoze pushes you know over the side and then compacting it and making a new road and then all bets are off now. Again, it's pending what the engineers say because you don't know what's going to happen above when you start removing, of course, from the bottom. It's like being in a sand pit. You know, you start digging in the corner and it just keeps falling in. And that's the reality of this whole mountain. So
yeah,
we don't know at this point, really.
Right. Okay. The bridge, you say, would be maybe completed by mid-September. However, you'd still have to come from the north, right?
Right. So that'll be the date when all the main businesses and places in Big Stir that are now been cut off, like Esalen, you know, the famous Nepenthe restaurant, the Henry Miller Library, Ventana and Post Ranch Inn. Those are the big private enterprises in Big Sur, and they're all cut off now. And when the bridge is in, then it'll be open. But of course, less traffic because you know the true traffic is the majority of people visiting Big Sur. Mm-hmm. That's the main enjoyment for the vast majority of people visiting Big Sur is the drive.
Yeah. So the summer tourist season, what are people talking about?
Well, you know, it's really traumatic for the community. Many people down there are suffering. The Henry Miller Library is suffering. I mean, we're losing an enormous amount. We're a small nonprofit, you know, and there are several others. So it's not an easy time. I can tell you that. And also with the specter of not being able to open up the road to the south, like we just spoke of, that the Mud Creek road won't be fixed for quite some time, certainly not before the end of the year, I doubt. So the amount of visitors is going to be very little in all of 2017. So it's a tough time for the community down there.
How are you going about your daily life? How are you getting necessities? How does this impact
you? We've had the road to the south. It gets a little complicated for your listeners. Like you said, it's good to have a map. But there is actually a narrow road that goes over the Santa Lucia Mountains, over to the Salinas Valley. And then there is a place on the highway where the highway workers allow locals to get through with an ID. Again, so that we can get supplies. So there is a supply route. Early on, when we were completely cut off and there were no supply routes open, there were a couple of helicopter deliveries to help out with. Some people needed medicine and a few other things. But at this point, there is a possibility of, you know, sort of connecting physically with the outside world for pretty much everyone. So that's how it works. I myself have a place on the what we call the Big Sur Island, so I have gone over that that escape route several times already this last month. And we have, you know, a lot of people in Pixar are sort of prepared for this stuff. So they have supplies for several months ready for this kind of an emergency. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, is it making people wonder about the long-term viability of living there? If this can happen this year, it can surely happen again.
No,
and
I know.
Are people thinking, well, maybe it's not worth it?
I don't think people think it's not worth it particularly, but I think, you know, I myself think, I just kind of speculating as to what's going to happen if that road to the south is completely, you know, done for, which it's theoretically possible. I mean, if you have another wet winter and we have three or four more of those major damages, then maybe the true traffic will be a thing of the past. You never know. And that'll change the equation, of course. It'll also make Big Sur a lot more quiet, which on one, you know, I don't want to, it's a tough one to talk about, but it's also a wonderful time, right? It's my favorite time in Big Sur. It's why everybody loves Big Sur. It's why everybody goes there in a way. Ultimately, it's to seek that tranquility and that natural beauty and untrammeled wilderness. And now, you know, the people who are there are getting it, perhaps a little too dramatically so, but nevertheless, many of the people that are down there are really, on some level, enjoying it, as do the animals and the wildlife that are coming out and walking on the highway. And a neighbor of mine saw a mountain lion calmly walk down in the center of Highway 1 one morning.
Beautiful. So, all right, we'll have to end it there with that picture of the mountain lion in our heads. It's actually quite a nice one. Magnus Torin, Executive Director of the Henry Miller Memorial Library, thank you.
Thank you.
And have a great long weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you on Monday.